Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, whenever you're listening, and welcome to Tri-State at the Plate. I'm your host, Andy Burdick, and alongside me is the Ginger Prince of Baseball Talk, Robert Finkbeiner.
How you doing?
And we have our super producer, Wonderkind, Jason Ruggiero.
Good to be here.
Spring training games start this weekend, and we'll have baseball from now until November. Gentlemen, how does that make you feel?
Wonderful.
I can't wait to actually see baseball happen on the field.
That's going to be great, yeah. Although I do love all the positive talk and all the hope that is springing eternal at this point in the year, it's going to be a lot more fun once we get the actual games underway. Last couple weeks, I've been failing to mention our awesome intro song is played by none other than Mr. Ruggiero's band, The Closers. So we want to give them a big, big thanks and a big shout out for having that awesome intro there.
No problem. More than happy to do it.
So I need to make sure I clear the air on this. On the last podcast, I mentioned that young Pirates ace Jameson Taillon, or ace in the making, I should say, Jameson Taillon was pitching for Team USA. That is factually incorrect.
Factually incorrect. That comes wrong from Fantasy Focus. I believe we have to give credit.
Yeah, we should give them credit. Although I feel like that's a really common statement that you would make anytime that you state something that is a fact that is not correct.
I believe, though, on the air, they make fun of people.
Do
that
they?
Don't give them credit.
Well, I mean, all the credit in the world to them for putting those for putting those words together for the first time in history. Jameson Taillon is actually pitching for Team Canada, so viva Canada.
I don't think that's how that works.
Yeah, I don't know. No. Go Canada. Go Canada, eh?
Maybe.
Drink a pint of maple syrup and... Yeah. Raise the Jolly Roger, is that right?
Raise the Jolly Roger, yeah.
I think the Viva Canada might work well in Quebec.
In Quebec.
Quebec.
They march to a different
beat. Tune, yeah, different beat.
So on today's show, we're going to talk a little bit about what's been going on in spring training. We've got a little more going on with each of our respective organizations. At the end, we're going to have our pop-up culture segment. Because it was such a hit the first time, we're going to be looking at the baseball movie called Ball Player Pelotero. A pretty interesting movie that we have watched. So we're going to start off today with the Pittsburgh Pirates. They have extended their manager, Clint Hurdle, which is kind of a, I don't want to say unappreciated signing, but Pirates fans are split on it, to say the least. I've seen a lot of positive and a lot of negative. The most common negative response to Clint Hurdle signing seems to be that he bunts too much. He's not a great in-game manager. I don't have a problem with Hurdle. He seems to be a great player manager. Players respond to him. Players, especially like Andrew McCutchen, who seem to really matter to our team, really support Hurdle. And even though we've collapsed over the last couple years, they've stood by him and said, this isn't on Hurdle. This is on the players, so don't put this on Hurdle. So I'm fine with the Clint Hurdle signing. Like I said, I think he's a great players manager. The players are responding to him right now. And you've seen kind of how that can wear off after a while. It seemed to happen in Cleveland with Manny Acta, where everybody was really on board with him. But by the end of his tenure there, everybody was ready to run him out of town with the pitchforks and torches. I don't know if you guys see any parallels like that between Hurdle and Acta.
Well, one thing, I think Hurdle is much more vocal. Mm. And Acta just kind of faded away.
I read today, not to get into the Indians right now, but I read today that Manny Acta apparently at the beginning of his tenure made a point to say, I'm not going to get overly excited. I don't want to like fall into that Latin
stereotype.
Ozzie Guillen?
Yeah, like Ozzie Guillen. But there's a point when you need to go out there and, you know, kick some dirt around and maybe get tossed if that's what it takes.
I was going to say, I can't remember if I read this somewhere, if someone told me that Manny Acta had the fewest ejections in baseball over his tenure in that period of time.
I don't know that for a fact, but that sounds right.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me.
I know that when Sandy Alomar Jr. took over as the interim manager at the end of last season, I was actually in the kitchen, I don't know, washing dishes or something with the game blaring in the other room. And, I heard probably Matt Underwood say, and Sandy Alomar Jr. is coming out of the dugout. And I ran into the other room. Oh, my goodness. What? I haven't seen this for 2 years.
Just to see someone get tossed out.
I want to see the manager defend these players. I haven't seen this.
Baseball tradition. It's like fighting in hockey. I love it.
Right. So to your point, you know, the collapse maybe has a few parallels. But as you said, the players are still behind him. And there were... not really publicly any Indians players that came out and said they wanted Maniac to go on, but it was kind of understood that he had lost the clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and from what you're saying, that's not the case, especially with players like Kutch, who are so important to the team.
Exactly. So the Buccos start their spring training schedule against the Rays on Saturday. It's a split squad game. That'll be the first game in our spring training schedule. And then the following day, they are playing their first home game against Atlanta. Some interesting news that I saw from John Paul Morosi at Fox Sports. He tweeted that during the wild card era, only one other franchise has held a playoff position on July 25th or later in consecutive seasons and finished with the losing record each time. That would be the Pittsburgh Pirates of the last 2 years and the 2005-2006 Arizona Diamondbacks. So, Pirates fans, we are not alone in our suffering. The 2005-2006 Diamondbacks are also there with us. There's been talk recently, this article was on Trib Live, that team president Frank Coonerly wants to sign Neil Walker, and it's a possibility for the franchise to do that. Walker's 27 years old and signed for $3.3 million this year. He has 3 years left of salary arbitration remaining. The funny thing was, and this came from John Paul Morosi as well, that Neil Walker said he's not aware of any recent conversations between his agent and the Pirates about a long-term deal. This kind of all goes back to my feelings about management at the moment, which is there seems to be a lot of miscommunication or inappropriate communication or communication or lack of communication between parties. So you end up with things like taking your million-dollar prospects and putting them through Navy SEAL training or losing your agreement with the State College Spikes and moving your team from a stadium that was built to your ballpark's dimensions to Jamestown. Things like that seem to be happening in Pittsburgh, and I don't know if it's an organizational thing or if it's just my perception as a Pirates fan. When I see things like this, I don't see other organizations that are dealing with things like this, so I don't know what the real deal with it is, but these kind of things stand out to me, and they seem to happen more frequently to the Pirates than to other teams that I follow.
I mean, there's always the chance that it's one of those situations where Walker has basically told his agent, don't bother me about a contract until, you know, we're down to the specifics.
Yeah, until something real is there.
And so maybe his agent is in negotiations and he just doesn't really know.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, you'd think it might come up at some time. The agent might call him and say, hey, they have contacted me. Just want to let you know that.
A couple other notes. Pedro Alvarez apparently worked hard this offseason at IMG Academy to get into shape. I don't know if you heard me calling him Fatty McFatfat from the stands last season.
That was wonderful news.
coming into the 2013 season, he seems to be in great shape. And everybody in the article that I read mentioned that everybody was coming to watch him in his at-bats because the ball was just jumping off the bat. And it was, you know, kind of, you get that where people say the ball sounds different coming off his bat. He was getting those loud cracks where people were starting to pay attention.
Well, at a game last year, I saw him in a squad interleague game against the Indians on, I believe, it was Father's Day. He had two home runs, another ball off the left center field wall that must have been hit screaming at 200 miles per hour. It's just a rocket.
He has those stretches.
Yeah. I mean, he can carry, and he did at points last season. He carried the Pirates roster on his shoulders, and then other points where his average dips below .198, and you just cringe every time he comes up to the plate. Then the last thing from Pirates camp, Jeff Karstens was already scratched from a BP session. He had soreness in his bicep area. And this kind of goes back to Neil Huntington already talking about how he wants Karstens to take that fourth spot. And you look at some of the signings that we've made with Jonathan Sanchez, and we have our guys coming into camp, you know, Kyle McPherson coming in and, you know, Francisco Liriano. You can never have too many arms that can throw baseballs because you're going to have things like this happening all season long. And Karstens, who's already dealt with injuries over the past few years, isn't, you know, a guaranteed lock to throw 200 innings for you. So you need those able arms there that can step in and replace him if the situation arises. So that's about all from Pirates camp. Let's move on to Detroit and see what's happening over there with Bob.
Okay, Tigers had some interesting notes this past week. The competition for the fifth spot in rotation should heat up a little bit this weekend where Leland said that Rick Porcello will make his spring debut this Friday. And I'm sure we'll see young lefty Drew Smalley here this weekend as well. Rule 5 pick. Jeff Coburnus is an interesting story because I believe that he might push for a Don Kelly-esque role.
What team did he come from?
He actually acquired in a pre-arranged deal from the Washington Nationals, where Tigers made a deal with the Red Sox to trade outfielder Justin Henry for Coburnus.
Okay.
Last year he spent time in Harrisburg, AA Eastern League, which he led the league in stolen bases despite being injured twice last season.
So this is a guy that we could be looking at seeing in Erie potentially to start off the year?
No, Rule 5 pick.
Okay.
So he has to begin the season with the big club or possibly get sent back to Washington.
Or he gets sent back. So, right. And your Rule 5 picks, just to clarify, your Rule 5 picks have to be on the
25-man roster.
All
season.
The entire year.
Entire year.
Or be offered back to their original team at half the cost.
Yep.
Or you can then work out a trade. If you actually work out a trade with the original team, then you get the player and whatever options they have left.
Oh, the economics of baseball. Oh,
yeah. Very interesting. What's neat, though, about him, he's primarily a second baseman with above-average defense but plus speed. The guy is quick on the bases, and he's actually learned how to play outfield this spring. So we'll see what happens. We'll monitor that. Additionally, the young Tigers fans can see a potential future outfield on Friday with Nick Castellanos playing left field, Avisail Garcia in right field, and center field being held down by Quinton Berry. And then on Saturday, Major League mentioned that he'll go with Dierks, Jackson, and Hunter. And really lastly, basically discuss how the Tigers camp is, don't look for Garcia or Castellanos to spend any time as a bench player or platoon player, as GM Dombrowski wants to get those guys every day at bats.
So they're going to get every day at bats somewhere, whether it's either in the majors, assuming that they're on the Major League roster, they're going to be everyday starters playing regularly. Or if they're not going to get those regular at-bats, they're going back down to the farm?
That's my take. And I would say probably somewhere combination of Toledo, or maybe one's in Erie, one's Toledo, or vice versa.
I mean, just looking at Castellanos last year when we went to Erie and saw him, you know, there's no doubt that he has those baseball skills. You look at him swing, you look at him throw, you look at him out in the field, and he just belongs there. He's definitely a baseball player. But my impression, just looking at him physically, he still has some room where he could fill out, I think, to, you know, kind of put on some weight to carry him through, the rigors of a whole 162-game season.
And we were discussing, too, on the way over here, that Castellanos, he has a solid bat. The ball jumps off that bat again. Solid contact. Power should develop.
Yeah. I want to say Baseball America on the 20-80 had his power at 55 right now, so a little bit above average, but nothing spectacular. His hit, I think Baseball America rated as a 70 on the 20-80. So, you know, he definitely makes that consistent contact. He's good at driving the ball, but they're still waiting for him to make that jump with the power. And there were, when we saw him in Erie, I think he was kind of mired in a slump the couple times that we went up and saw him in Erie. You know, he wasn't hitting the ball well. Statistically speaking, I guess you would look at his numbers and think, oh, you know, this guy's really not. But, you know, the games that we went to see him, he was making good contact.
Well, definitely.
You know, he was lacing the ball. You know, there were a couple Adam balls.
And defensively, he showed a good arm, strong arm in right field, which is playing in Erie. Although they're going to have him left field, though, on Friday.
Yeah. So I think that'll be kind of curious to see, too, if he does start out the season in AA Erie, kind of how Erie manages him. You know, where are they going to shift him? Are they going to work with him just primarily in right because that's where they want him ending up? Or do they want him starting to look at those balls coming off all the different angles and all the different outfield positions? And Erie kind of gives you that unique dimension too, where if you haven't been to Jarriott Park in Erie, if you're playing left field, now they've gotten rid of that walkway on the left field wall, and it's just a solid wall all the way up.
Yep.
So, you know, you kind of get that interesting dimension where, you know, if the ball hits that wall and it bounces off there, how are you going to play it? So I'm always curious to see how players kind of adjust to things like that.
Well, I do believe, though, the mention of the outfield fence, though, is still the same. So
yeah, the fence still is the same. Right. Yeah. But it's one of those tall walls you know, the ball bounces off it and you got to kind of play it off there. I mean, it's not the big green monster big, but, you know, it's tall. You're not robbing a home run ball there. That's for sure.
Yeah. Gets hit over your head, you're just going to turn and play the carom.
Exactly.
There's nothing to go after out there.
Yeah.
Right.
Good. All right. Well, let's move on to Cleveland and see what we have going on with the Tribe so far this spring.
Well, the big news out of Indians camp this last week was Terry Francona making it pretty clear that even though he's got Bourne in center field, Stubbs in right field, and Brantley in left field, and Swisher at first, who can also play right field, he's going to be looking to carry a true fourth outfielder. You know, he's not going to count Swisher as his backup outfielder, essentially. So that makes things kind of interesting. There's a few guys in camp. Some are prospects. Some have come over in Rule 5. They kind of come from various directions. But you've got a guy like Zeke Carrera, who's out of options this year, but has had time in the majors the last 2 years. He's kind of underwhelmed at the plate in those two seasons. He's been a average defender, but I think people expected more from him in the outfield. He's quick, and that's, I think, partly why people were disappointed with
his defense.
At the plate, over two seasons, he's batted .255 with a .306 on base for a .653 OPS.
A little weak.
So that's not really what you're looking for. He has played winter ball, and he's wrapped up with that, obviously. But over, I think it was like about 125 plate appearances in winter ball, he batted .286 with a .779 OPS. So that's kind of trending in the right direction if you're Carrera. The other interesting guy is Tim Fedroff, who actually was the 2012 Minor League Player of the Year for the Indians last year. He wasn't on the 40-man roster last September. Everyone was kind of pulling for him to get called up to see what he could do. The season was pretty much lost anyway. But he wasn't on the 40-man roster, and they didn't want to make that move. They did add him this offseason to protect him in the Rule 5 draft. He's 26 years old. They drafted him in 2008. And last year in AAA, he hit .316 with an .879 OPS. And he played part of a season the year before in AAA, I believe. So his cumulative OPS in AAA is .828. So this is a guy that's repeated his level. He hasn't played two full years there, but he's repeated the level and repeated his results. And everyone's kind of wondering, you know, what are the possibilities for a guy like Tim Fedoroff? Can he make the team? So it's hard to say. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. He was in AA and AAA last year. And in AAA, he actually had a .910 OPS. He actually exceeded his AA numbers. Those first ones, the .879, that was AA. .910 was AAA. So he had a very good year last year, but he never got the call. So he's definitely in contention there. Then the interesting thing is, since they have three center fielders, basically, in Bourne, Brantley, and Stubbs, they don't need the traditional fourth outfielder that can play center, because they already have backup center fielders. They have tons of center fielders. So a guy like Mike McDade that they picked up in the offseason, who's more of a corner, not quite a true power threat, but he does have some power in him. He has potential to make the team. A guy like Chris McGinnis that they picked up in the Rule 5 draft, he has the potential to make the team. He's kind of a similar player to McDade. And then a guy like Yan Gomes, who they picked up in the Mike Aviles trade from, drawing a blank here. They got Aviles from the
Blue Jays. And they sent Ismael Rogers.
Right. For Ismael Rogers. Gomes, is an interesting guy because he can play catcher, first, maybe a little third, left and right. He chose not to take part in the WBC. He's actually from Brazil. He's the first native Brazilian to make it to the major leagues, actually.
Really?
Yeah, and he chose not to play in the WBC, even though his game-winning RBI hit got Brazil into the tournament.
Into the tournament, huh?
Because he really feels like he has a chance to make the 25-man roster, and he doesn't want to leave camp. So he's a guy that I'm really interested in, partly because if you bring a guy like that to camp, you have that extra catching flexibility that makes you feel a little easier about DHing a guy like Carlos Santana, because you've not boxed yourself into a corner with Lou Marson. And, I mean, Marson is pretty much assumed to be the backup catcher. But, I mean, you know, Marson has not been overwhelming with his bat. And then last year, he really did struggle catching.
Yeah, defensively. Yeah. Actually, last year, he wasn't. Because that used to be the big thing about Lou Marson was, well, he can't hit. He doesn't have a stick, but at least he's, you know, good defensively.
And so the interesting thing is Carlos Santana is going to the WBC. And
his defense actually improved last year.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is Terry Francona said, I'm not disappointed that Santana won't be in camp, but it's tough in my first camp to not have my catcher. But I'll get a chance to look at Marson and Gomes. So I think it's going to be interesting. An interesting spring for both of them, especially if Marson really struggles throughout the spring and if Gomes has a good spring. It could be interesting to see what they do there. I don't think they're really married to Lou Marson as their backup catcher. I think they're going into camp assuming that's what's going to happen, but Gomes could work his way into that spot.
Well, Jason, let me ask you this. In the fourth outfield area,
yes,
you didn't mention the now healthy Matty Laporta.
Well, I talked about that in my spring training notebook a little. Matt Laporta says he's healthy. He says that his hip is ready to go. He went through his second surgery this last offseason on his hip.
But where do you see the chances of him making it on 25-man roster out of the spring?
As I said in the article, I'm intrigued to see how Matt Laporta hits this spring. From his description of his problems, he was saying that when he went to the surgeon made the comment, I don't know how you functioned on a day-to-day level, let alone play baseball with your hip like this. That's great. But unless his hip was keeping him from hitting off-speed pitches, I'm not really sure how that factors in. And maybe it was. I mean, maybe he'll have a much more balanced and fluid approach this summer or this spring. That would be great. I don't really expect that to happen, though.
I think it's safe to say we can now start referring to him as the ghost of Matt Laporta.
Well, and the other thing, to your point, if you want to, you know, look at it from a business aspect, Laporta cleared waivers and was outrighted to AAA. You've got a guy like McGinnis who you picked up in the Rule 5. You've got guys like Gomes, McDade, Fedroff, who have either come from organizations or have been in this one for a while and are waiting for their chance. And then you've got Carrera, who's out of options.
And we still do have Russ Kanzler, too, don't we?
Well,
or is he gone?
I think he's gone again. He's been traded, I think, 4 times this offseason. Let me pull that up right now. Kanzler.
That's right, yes.
I think he's the Orioles property now. I'm pretty sure, yeah.
It wasn't us, property. Blue Jays. Back to us, Yankees.
And then the
Baltimore.
Orioles. Yeah. 5 times.
Poor guy.
Not traded, designated.
So let me ask you guys this, because this seems to be a trending topic with the Indians, and it's been kind of a topic in Pittsburgh as well the last few seasons with Garrett Jones. When you have a guy like Nick Swisher, or when you have a guy like Garrett Jones who doesn't have a definite position, do managers look into which way to best use a player defensively, or do you think that they're looking primarily at what they can do with the stick and how to best fit them in the lineup that way? Because we were listening to that interview with Swisher upstairs. Was that on STO? So that interview with Swisher, and when they brought up the fact that he's playing first base, and Francona's outright said, we're going to have Swish at first.
Yeah.
Swisher had this big grin on his face, and he had a big sigh, and he said, yeah, I was really happy when I heard that I was playing first base. Like, that's where he wants to be.
Yeah, he said he's tired of hearing people tell him he's a slow outfielder.
But when you look at his metrics, too, I mean, he's a pretty bad outfielder.
Yeah.
He's an average first baseman. I mean, he plays good defense at first base.
And as he said in the interview, that's really the position he came up playing.
Right.
He never played the outfield till he was drafted. So I think he is truly more comfortable at first base. But I think, you know, I mean, obviously there's other things that factor in. Like, they had Mark Reynolds and they were assuming Mark Reynolds was going to play first. Well, then, you know, because they were short an outfielder and they didn't want to start one of the guys that I just listed. They didn't want to start an Ezekiel Carrera again. They've already been down that road. They said, well, we'll put Swish in right field and we'll put Reynolds at first. But then when you have Bourne come in the picture, you know, and you have a chance to have a Stubbs Brantley Bourne outfield, I think it you know, it changes things. So, I mean, I think we're going to see Nick Swisher in the outfield. I think they're going to really try to protect Drew Stubbs in his splits. He has a very bad split against left-handers, I believe, even though he's right-handed. I'm pretty sure that's accurate. I'll pull it up.
Yeah, check that out.
We're going to see Nick Swisher in the outfield, but I think in his case, I think the difference between him and Garrett Jones is you get Nick Swisher in the lineup every day. It doesn't matter. If he has to play in the outfield, he plays in the outfield. You have to DH him, whatever. A guy like Garrett Jones, because there can be some ups and downs to his performance, there's other factors, I think, that come into play more.
Yeah. And that's why that another point that I wanted to make, kind of relating to Garrett Jones and Clint Hurdle, going back to the beginning of the podcast, is that one of the things that I think Hurdle did exceptionally well last year was managing Garrett Jones, protecting him when he was in the lineup, finding Garrett Jones has awful splits against lefties, but finding lefties that Garrett Jones could hit against, be successful against, and keeping him in the lineup. As a result, Garrett Jones put together one of the best seasons of his career last year. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you start to really see a manager earn their medal, is how are you managing those players? You know, Garrett Jones is a prime example of that. We got optimum value out of Garrett Jones. I think Garrett Jones, it's safe to say, exceeded all expectations in his performance last year because Clint Hurdle was able to put him in positions to be successful.
And by all accounts, he still has high value on the trade market too.
Oh, absolutely.
If Pirates want to dim away for other talent.
Absolutely. We have any info on Stubbs' splits over there?
I'm trying to pull up more than just his 2012 splits. It's not cooperating right now.
Oh, technology.
The only other thing I was going to say, I'll work on those in a second. The only other thing I was going to say is I think it's going to be interesting, too, to see how Lonnie Chisenhall performs this spring and this season. This is a guy that was a first-round pick in 2008. He's still very young. He is he's a 29th pick, actually, in 2008. The Indians actually had a good year leading up to that one. But he's really actually – this has surprised me when I looked it up. He's only accumulated 374 plate appearances in the majors. So he hasn't even played a full season.
Right.
He was hit by a pitch last year, fractured his forearm, and he missed, I think it's 63 games. And then he was hit in the head by a fastball, Carlos Villanueva fastball in 2011. They never really said he had a concussion, but he looked like he was in a nasty bar fight and he missed about a week and a half or a week or something like that. And he never was quite the same in the, you know, 2 weeks or so after that hit. But over those 374 plate appearances, he's got 12 home runs. I think that's 38 RBIs. My writing's terrible. 260 average and a 716 OPS. So his average is pretty solid. His OPS leaves a little something to be desired, but he's got a 421 slugging. So it's all coming from his on base. And if you look at his, he's got 16 walks against 70 strikeouts. So that's, I mean, and they said all last spring that was going to be his goal, was better plate discipline, working, you know, for a walk, controlling the strike zone. But this is the first time in his life that someone said, hey, kid, third base is yours.
Right.
You don't have to worry about anything. Jack Hanahan isn't here. We're not going to take you out in the end of the game because you made an error earlier. We're not going to pinch hit for, you know, this is your job. And the other interesting thing is when you start to make a batting order with Bourne and Swisher and Brantley and Santana, Cabrera, Kipnis, Reynolds, Avilas maybe, all of a sudden Lonnie Chisenhall, who sometimes last year was batting fifth, mm-hmm, or sixth,
or six, yep,
is batting eighth or ninth, where a kid like that should be batting. And the thing is, you put a kid down there who might hit 260, 270 and 20 home runs batting eighth, you know, whereas last year, there were times he was the best batter in the order on days when they gave, you know, a Kipnis or a Cabrera the day off.
It could be the same situation that the Indians had in the early, mid-90s when they had a youngster named Jim Thome, third baseman,
right,
batting seventh or eighth.
Yeah.
Manny Ramirez playing right field, batting seventh or eighth.
Right.
Well, I think the thing that we need to reiterate too is Lonnie Chisenhall is only 24 going into this season. He is young. If you give him some time to develop, and I personally felt, you know, Cleveland rushed him a little bit. He didn't seem to really master each of the levels as they promoted him up to the big. So I think he just does need that time to develop. He needs to be kind of in the lower half of that order where there's not a lot of pressure on him, and it just kind of gives him that time.
And the thing is, he did get, you know, he was kind of on the fast track, and I think if you look at the numbers, he holds his own pretty much through Akron, and then he stumbled maybe a little bit in Columbus, or it might have been, well, I guess it would have been Columbus, not Buffalo. Yeah. But they needed someone, and, you know, he had a good spring, so they brought him up. They were trying to be aggressive. And then just when he kind of started to get in the rhythm, he got hit in the head.
Yep.
And then the next year, just when he got in the rhythm, he got hit in the arm and broke his arm. I think, yeah, here we go. He was actually batting .286 before he got hit in the arm last year and broke his arm, and he batted .257 after. So you can see, you know, he's starting to get in the groove, get comfortable a little, and he's out. And in some places, you see that he's gotten this kind of knock that he's injury prone. But I mean, when you stand in the batter's box and get plunked twice,
right?
That's kind of part of your job description.
I mean, that's not injury prone. You know, if you actually look at his injury history, there's not much on there that is not from getting hit. I think actually all four of his injuries, if you look at his reference page, are from getting hit.
Yeah.
Two in the minors and two in the majors. So it'll be interesting. He actually struggled with his defense last year, and that's not something anyone thought was going to be a problem. But I think it'll be an interesting spring and season for Lonnie Chisenhall, because he's not going anywhere. If you're looking for the Indians, they're playing this Friday against Cincinnati. They share the same facility with Cincinnati. At 3:05 Eastern time, that'll be on good old WTAM 1100, the Indians flagship station. The voice of the Indians there, Tom Hamilton. They'll play the Reds again on Saturday at 3:05. That's on WTAM as well. On Sunday, they play a split squad against Milwaukee and the Reds at 3:05. And then they continue on. Most of the games are at 3:05 since they are out in Arizona. And on Friday, they were going to start Scott Kazmir, which I was excited to see. Kazmir has said he's not hurt. He just feels like he would like to pitch another bullpen before they put him out on the mound. Terry Francona said, "I'm glad he told me that. we want guys to be honest with us." So they're going to actually start Giovanni Soto.
Ooh,
who
interesting.
Is the prize for Johnny Peralta they got several years ago from the Tigers.
Threw a no-hitter in Akron last year, I believe.
He did. He had a great year in Akron last year. He had a 3.93 ERA, and he went 6-9, but he had a 1.39 whip, and I'm trying to see here, basically a 2 strikeout-to-walk ratio. So he had a really good year last year in Akron. He's going to be in the WBC for Puerto Rico, so this might be, you know, the last time you see Soto for too long, because he's going to be missing from Indians camp for a while.
And in case you were wondering about Drew Stubbs, his splits, he favors lefties. Against righties, he has 1,491 plate appearances with a career .228 average.
Ooh. There you go.
So his splits tend to favor the lefties. So.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. Again, you know, I said I think managers can kind of work players into favorable at-bats against even their weaker splits. So I'll be curious to see how Tito does there with that.
Right. Well, and that may hurt a guy like Tim Fedorov or Zeke Carrera, because they both bat left-handed.
Yeah. Well, let's transition into pop-up culture, where we'll be looking at some culturally relevant things. We'll typically try and make sure that they deal with baseball in some capacity, because that is the primary goal of this show. Today, we're going to be taking a look at a movie, a documentary called Ball Player, Pelotero. This movie follows two baseball players, Jean Carlos Batista and... some of you may be familiar with Miguel Sano, who is currently considered one of the best prospects in baseball and the number one prospect in the Minnesota Twins system. Some interesting things while you watch this. This movie, it follows these, and you literally have to call them kids. It follows these kids, they're teenagers, when this movie is watching them down in the Dominican. And as teenagers, these kids have the pressure of having to play for millions of dollars. You know, an age where most kids here in the States are getting their learner's permits, these kids are potentially worrying about taking care of their families for generations. You watch this, and it's really interesting to see because the cultures differ so drastically. You look at an area where the majority of the people are impoverished, and they look at baseball as a way to escape the poverty that they live in, whereas here we look at baseball as something to do for fun, a recreation. And one of the things that really stood out to me when I first started watching this documentary was they were interviewing some Dominican ball players who were in camp. You know, again, it's a room full of teenagers. They're all laughing and talking. And one of the people asked them, what's the difference between Dominican ball players and American ball players? And this teenager, this kid responded, American ball players are lazy. That was his response. That was how he viewed it. You know, they look at it as, we're going to work hard. We're going to fight and scratch and earn everything that we can because this is better than any opportunity that we have presented to us right now.
Which, you know, on that comment, which was, you know, very applicable to our society and baseball culture now, it's ironic that the criticism has been to those Latin American players when they land that big contract and have some success in the major leagues, what happens to them?
Mm-hmm.
They tend to get lazy.
That's what you hear. And oftentimes I feel like that's an overblown, inappropriately used way to describe someone. Describing someone as lazy. You know, like when Hanley Ramirez got that tag quite a bit. You know, he was described, oh, he didn't, you know, if he worked as hard as he could and he played to his potential all of the time, that he could be, you know, an MVP every year. And then you see Hanley Ramirez boot a ground ball and just lollygag after it and kick it a little bit farther by accident and lollygag after it. And you go, yeah, that guy is lazy. After watching this, I have a hard time believing.
Well, the point is, what I'm making, I know that Jason can back me up here, is that it's not so much their actual ability, it's what happens in the off seasons. They come back to camp and they, instead of weighing 205 pounds, they show up at 230. And you're wondering, whoa, what just happened here?
Right.
They're still trying to play the game as if they were at 205, only they just haven't put the conditioning into it,
mm-hmm.
which is, we've seen that happen.
I mean,
with
how many times do we see, you know, reports? I mean, just looking at Indian shortstops, how many times did Johnny Peralta report to camp out of shape? How many times did Asdrubal Cabrera report to camp out of shape? So
Carlos Baerga,
yeah. And I think there's no denying that. I mean, those you can find those articles reporting those guys. But I think to Andy's point, you know, a lot of times it's an easy out for a broadcaster who's frustrated with a player.
Oh, right.
To call him describe, lazy.
He's right. Lazy.
Yeah.
You know, I have no idea. It does boggle my mind why players routinely show up to camp overweight. But... you know, I think those two things come together a little bit, but they're also two separate things at the same time.
Exactly.
Some of it's lazy journalism and some of it is players being lazy.
Right. And I don't think, I mean, there's plenty of other players that come to camp out of shape that aren't Dominican born that I think a lot of it, you know, it is a cultural thing in baseball that once you get a lot of money, maybe you feel that sense of
entitlement.
You know, I don't go home with these guys. I don't go to them in the off season. I have no idea what they do. You know, I know when Pedro Alvarez comes to camp and he is overweight, though. You know, it makes me a little irate.
Yeah.
But after watching it, I really have a hard time believing that they would ever really forget that level of poverty that they came from. I mean, it was amazing for me to look at that and to think like this is where a 15-year-old kid starts his working career. He starts his career on these, you know, these backfields in the Dominican. I mean, it blew my mind watching it. Some interesting things that they pointed out in this documentary was that 20% of major and minor league ballplayers currently come from the Dominican Republic. 20% from that small population, that populates 20% of all major and minor league baseball players. It was interesting to see, too, how, and again, you have to remember, these are kids. These aren't college-age people. These are teenage kids. You know, when they start playing ball in the Dominican, they end up with these trainers. And these trainers kind of take on kids that they think they can work and develop because these trainers work on commission with major league clubs. They take on these kids, work with them for multiple years. Over this period of time, they may pay for medical bills, transportation, equipment. But when these kids sign, and the goal of the trainers is to get one of these kids to sign, they end up pulling in 35%, up to 35% of what these kids are end up being worth. I mean, when I was watching this, I seriously thought to myself, this is like, it's like looking at a puppy mill. I mean, it was awful for me to look at this and to think, like, this game that you grow up as a kid playing for fun down there is run by grown men basically farming teenage kids to try and get them into the major leagues, so that everybody's making money. It completely blew me away to watch this. One of the things that really stood out to me as a Pirates fan was Miguel Sano. He was being pursued pretty heavily by the Pittsburgh Pirates. And our director of scouting in the Dominican, Rene Gallo, just looked awful, awful in this film. I mean, it reflects. I'd read articles about how apparently scouting in the Dominican with Pittsburgh
was not very flattering.
No. I would go as far as to say it was very unflattering towards. And again, I don't know if this is how the whole organization is run top to bottom, or whether this is just some rogue guy going crazy because he wants to sign this prospect more than anyone else. But and you have to watch the documentary. We've kind of given a lot away already, but just to see how this whole thing with the Pirate scouting director unfolded was pretty crazy.
Well, and you know, as an Indians fan, I can't help but think about Fausto Carmona when you talk about the nightmare that the Dominican is for baseball players.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here's a guy, you know, you're talking about a trainer invests all this time in someone for that payout, that final 35% payout, you know, and that's not even all of it. Like, he, you know, in his case, he buys a different birth certificate from someone. He's probably got a trainer he has to pay off. He, you know, I mean, the trail of nonsense, basically, he had to go through to get to where he was. You know, he had to lie about his age, pay off someone for a birth certificate that he didn't pay for, which is allegedly the reason this all came about. You know, I'm sure there were people, you know, that he had to pay off in the beginning when he got the contract, because they were the ones that, you know, essentially promoted him and got his name out there and got the eye of organizations. And it's just, here's a guy, you know, it makes you realize, I guess, in a way, sometimes why these guys are fighting for that extra $1 million, because it's not just them. Like, they have a whole trail of people that they're either trying to settle up with or keep quiet or whatever the case might be behind them.
And that was one of the things at the beginning of the documentary, too. They were talking to a room full of those ball players, and they said, you know, yeah, you have to lie about your age. It's just kind of, that's the way it is. Yeah. If you're more marketable as a 19-year-old or as an 18-year-old, you know, that's what you do because that's what they need to do. And it kind of reminded me, it drew a lot of parallels again to the steroid era with me, where I don't blame athletes for taking steroids. It's millions of dollars involved, and they felt like it was what they needed to do for their career at the time. And I don't think anyone's really in a place to say, to judge those people for doing what they did at the time. And I feel the same way about those ball players. But it's a really interesting documentary to watch. It's about an hour and a half long. So if you have a chance, you can check it out at pilotero.themovie.com. It's also available on Netflix Instant. That was how I watched it. I was streaming it on Netflix. So if you have some extra time and you want to learn a little bit about baseball in the Dominican.
And one more note to our listeners, it's interesting to note that Bobby Valentine helped produce.
Yeah, he was a producer for the documentary. So, I don't know what that says about Bobby Valentine or the documentary, but Bobby Valentine was involved with the production of this film. So take that for what it's worth.
Well, he's very well respected in Japan.
Japan.
So. Bobby Valentine is huge in Japan. So that's going to wrap it up for today. We'd like to thank you for listening. You can check us out on the web at tsmbaseball.com. You can email us at tristatebb@tsmbaseball.com.
No emails this week.
You can follow us on the Twitter at tristatebb. And you can also like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tsmbaseball. A big thanks again to the Closers for our opening and closing song. If you're listening to us on iTunes, we would politely ask for a review on iTunes. Those reviews kind of help drive our popularity up, and we greatly appreciate the one review that we already have. 5-star rave review. So keep your ear to the ground, be listening for us next week, and we'll have another podcast up for you. Stirs you up, makes you feel 15, and I gotta tell